peptide to relative gene expression than high-strain controls. In the high-strain, we see no effective treatment on insulin-like peptide 2 expression. But in low-strain bees, we see that VG knockdowns have significantly lower expression of insulin-like peptide 2. These results allowed us to confirm a connection, at least in the low-strain bees, between vitellogenin and insulin-like signaling. So we have results from two studies, the first of which confirmed a relationship between vitellogenin and behavior and life history. And in our low-strain bees, we see that vitellogenin knockdown results in an extended lifespan in low-strain bees. In our second study, we were able to show that the low-strain bees with reduced vitellogenin expression also have reduced expression of insulin-like peptide 2. And this is interesting because a single reproductively linked characteristic, vitellogenin expression, resulted in a difference in behavior and life history, as well as a difference in expression of an insulin-signaling peptide. So this is interesting because we know from solitary insects that insulin signaling is connected to both reproduction and life history. So our next step is to directly measure the connection in honeybees between behavior and life history and insulin signaling. Several members of both the Page and Omdon labs contributed a lot to this study, as well as many members of the Social Insect Research Group at Arizona State University. Thanks. Right, we see a faster onset of foraging and an earlier death, which is typically coupled with the earlier onset of foraging, so yes.
Meaning that if you have that M factor, you are male. Homozygous males do exist where the M factor has two copies and you end up producing all male offspring if you're crossed with a normal female. So that's actually a problem. Obviously, you don't want to have all male offspring. And so what happens is females develop this F factor, and that's linked to the fourth chromosome. It's known what it is. It's epistatic to M and produces females even in the presence of up to four copies of an M in a male. And so this actually switches from the males being the heterogametic sex to the females being the heterogametic sex. And this diagram down here just shows the ancestral states with the XX, XY, and then these F and autosomal characteristics. So what's known in the linkage of M is that this is a previous study. 100% of the males in Florida are autosomal with the third chromosome determining sex. And then as you move north, you actually see that they become 100% Y males. What we're actually going to focus on today is this North Carolina strain that actually has a combination of 77.65% Y males, 20% autosomal males with the third chromosome determining sex, and then an interesting 2.35% that actually contain two M factors, one on the Y and one on the third chromosome. And so that's going to be the focus for the rest of the talk. We're going to come back to this slide, actually these numbers anyway. So the objectives are to look at the linkage and the frequency of M, determine the frequency of F in these populations, and then to look at changes over time. So over time in the lab and in the field, so two different sort of environmental conditions that can influence either the linkage and or the frequency of these. So some of the significance of this is actually the first time that anyone has looked at the frequency or linkage changes over time. A lot of studies have been done where they go to a site, they collect once, they look at what those numbers are, and that's it. And so this is the first time we've actually gone back to the same site more than once and collected and looked at these things. And it's also the first time to look for F in a U.S. population. Usually F is looked for when there's the presence of homozygous males. When you find that, you look for F because you are expecting to see them there. So the strains that were used are all from North Carolina. The NC2002 strain is that one we looked at previously on the graph. And then we have a Raleigh 2006 field collected strain and a 2007 field collected strain. And then we renamed NC Lab is actually this 2002 strain, but it's remained in the lab, so it's been in the lab under standard rearing conditions. How we look for M, we actually cross it with our Abbey's females. These have recessive markers on each of the five autosomes. We cross it to a field collected male, and then we get F1s. We count the ratio of males to females. We actually do a back cross to these Abbey's females again, and then we do three replicates of F1 males in case there's more than one M factor linkage group. And we phenotype the offspring and the marker, and we look for associations between sex and marker. So what we find, this is actually that pie chart that we saw just broken down into a bar graph. And if we look at after 4 years in the lab, what has happened to this population? Well, we notice, okay, the Y males are still there, they look good, but we actually lose all of these autosomal males. There are actually none there in the population now. So these autosomal males on the third chromosome somehow, some reason, don't like the lab. But we actually see an increase of males that are homozygous. And these can be XMYM or XMXM. We don't have a marker for the sex chromosomes, so we're unable to distinguish between those two. And so we find those actually dramatically increase. In fact, we didn't detect them in the field in 2002. So what happened in the field after 4 years? Not a lot, actually. So it looks very similar for Y. It looks very similar for the linkage group with the third chromosome. And we did detect one individual that was this genotype. So we assume that these were actually in this population when we collected them from the field. They were just at such a low level that under the 100 crosses that we didn't detect it the first year. So that's probably where these came from. And for some reason, the lab conditions select for those. And we went back one more year. So we thought, this looks very similar. So what's happening? Is this really a static population where things are staying the same? And we find, no, in fact, they're not. So the Y males actually increased the next year. These autosomal males decreased dramatically. And we still find this individual here. We actually ended up losing the multiple Y and autosomal male, but so that was undetected. But it was at a very low frequency always anyway, so that's not unusual. So we decided to look at F in these populations. And how we do this is we take a NC lab male, which has the 20% homozygous males. We cross them with our Abbey strain, which we know doesn't carry an F factor, and we cross them with one of our females of interest, whether this be the lab or the field strain. And if we get all males in this cross, we know that it's a homozygous male. And then if we get any females in this cross, we know that she has to carry F. Another example of this is you can use ratios to determine what the genotype of the female is. So if in this cross we get both males and females, we know that it's a heterozygous male. And if we get a 3-to-1 ratio, we get an F that is not carrying an M factor. So you'll get different ratios depending on what the genetics are. So for example, if you're going to get a 3-to-1 ratio, if these are the parentals, the female and male, you're going to get three females, one with F without M, one with F with M, one with neither of them, and then just an M male. And so therefore the 3-to-1 comes from there. So in the lab, the F frequencies, and you're going to see genotypes of the male and the female, the ratios that are produced, and then the percentage in the population. So we have heterozygous males, a female carrying M and F. That gives us a 1:1.65 ratio, and 24.5% of the population are those individuals. Just F females, 1:3 ratio produced, that's 9.4%. a homozygous M, F, where X is unknown because of the cross here, 1-to-1 ratio, 7.6% of the population. Females that do not carry F, that's 3.8%. And we have this possibility of both of these females will produce a 1-to-1 ratio. And so this is with a heterozygous male. We either have a homozygous female with F or a female that doesn't have any of them. And in that case, they both produce a 1-to-1 ratio, and we can't distinguish this F from no F. So that's 54.7% of the population. So we have to exclude those individuals just because we don't want to. So this is actually a conservative estimate of the total population, because some of these individuals are likely carrying F, but we're unable to distinguish those. So we total these at 41.5% of the population. So in the field, what is happening? So this column now is added, and that's going to be the lab percents from the previous slide, just to have a comparison. We actually don't see these two genotypes, so F with M or just F females in the heterozygous male state. We don't find any of those in the field. We find F at 4.2%, no F at 33.3%, and then those that we can't distinguish at 62%, and so a 4.2 estimate. So there's a dramatic difference between the field and the lab. So lab conditions increase homozygous males. Linkage can actually rapidly change in the field and in the lab. But we also have kind of some contradictory evidence of field conditions can maintain the linkage and frequency, or they can change rapidly depending on the year. So there's something going on in the field that's unclear what's happening. And also, F is actually present in field populations without a large percentage of homozygous males. And so I'd like to thank my lab and Wes Watson for collecting the flies in North Carolina and the funding partners. So I will take any questions.
Developed to become social. Social in a broad sense, meaning that they work together to be efficient at what they do. And one of the ways that the termites do this is by having different castes do different jobs. And some of the castes in the termite colony would be the worker caste, the reproductive caste, or the soldier caste. Well, how do individuals get to be these different castes? Well, termite caste differentiation overall is a long, complicated process that's reliant on many different factors. So, for example, as far as we know, all termite eggs are totipotent or have the ability.
So, yes, what I'll be talking about today, you can see up there, is U.S. honeybee populations. And when I use the word importation, I kind of realize that to some extent that we could be talking about Australian bees coming in next week or something, but I'm not really talking about that until the end. It's more of a historical perspective and some things about breeding practices, but I'll have to also mention Varroa. All right? Okay, next slide. Okay, well, if you think about the settlers coming to the New World, the European colonists, what they found was, you know, a vast, seemingly empty place, except for all the people that were already here, I suppose. But what they didn't find was honeybees. So honeybees are not native to the New World at all, the genus Apis, and instead they brought their honeybees with them. The honeybee, Apis mellifera, has a fairly interesting distribution relative to the other members of the genus. It is, it's over here in Africa, Europe, and Western Asia, and I'm going to never touch that thing again, okay? And the rest of the genus occurs over there in Eastern Asia. And within this vast range, a number of climates are, the bees actually exist within a number of climates, and as you might expect, have developed a lot of adaptations to those. And this is not moving. I did something wrong, didn't I? Try that. Okay. Just to give you one little hint of what we know of European subspecies of the variation within the honeybee. These subspecies names, Mellifera, Ligustica, Carnica, that you see there, are subspecies believed to have arisen following repeated glaciations in Europe, where glaciers forced the populations to be in small refugia. The glaciers then retreated, as you can see here, and what we now recognize as subspecies arose, in some cases, like Ligustica and Carnica, there being more or less hemmed in by the Alps. In the case of Mellifera, spreading all throughout northern Europe, eastward to the Ural Mountains. Okay, so the endemic range of the species is allopatric to the rest of the genus, and I should mention that the rest of the genus, there are about 8 or 9 other species. Africa, Europe, Central and Western Asia is the homeland, and there are 26 recognized subspecies. Here you can see about 25 of them, and kind of ignore that tectonic activity that moved Africa so far away from Spain. I don't quite know what went on there, but anyway, there are a number of subspecies related to Mediterranean islands and the ones that you saw there in Europe, and a number in Africa, not so related to glaciation but to other vegetative shifts and climate changes in the last certainly less than a million years. But that's kind of what we had to work with when Europeans now decided to leave Europe and go to the New World. Oh, just one little aside here. Those three stars over in the right are in the Tian Shan Mountains of Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan there. And this is the homeland of apples, and also fairly recently described subspecies occurs there. So this entire issue of allopatry and the native range of Apis mellifera is still kind of a topic of investigation. Okay, but so what about the history of the introduction of honeybees to the New World? Well, first we had European settlers from Western Europe arrive in the New World, so they brought their honeybee. They brought Apis mellifera mellifera, the dark bee of Northern Europe. Also, now other common names are the German black bee and names like that. And we know that they were established in Virginia by 1622. Once they were established, they were, as far as we know, kind of the only bee in town, because it was really expensive and difficult to bring other subspecies over in the days of sailing ships. And we have no records of any other subspecies being brought into the United States for about 230 years. One thing about this honeybee is it spread out rapidly in advance of the European settlers, and certainly within the eastern U.S. and fairly far west colonized and established a pretty substantial feral population. About 230 years after that, additional importations began, more or less about a decade following the development of steamship service between the New World and the Old World, and it took a shorter amount of time, and I presume was probably cheaper to get things back and forth. And it also followed a wave in Europe of attraction and excitement about subspecies that were being brought into Europe from around the Mediterranean. And we know that seven additional subspecies were introduced between 1859 and 1922. In 1922, following the reports of the discovery of the tracheal mite in Europe, the United States restricted further importation of honeybees from outside the United States, and it kind of worked until about 1984. This was the first subspecies that was brought in. After that, this was the Italian honeybee, Apis mellifera ligustica, and it's kind of hard to probably describe the excitement at the time of this new bee. It was yellow, it was considered beautiful, it was gentle, it appeared to be resistant to diseases, the diseases they knew about at the time. And this bee and descendants of this bee are the predominant honeybee of commerce now within the United States. I think the majority of beekeepers, especially these commercial beekeepers, are maintaining some variant of Italian honeybees. And here are the records. These are based on records in bee journals at the time of people that of either expeditions or people that brought them over and had them for sale of different subspecies. And I just have the trinomial name there. So the first one's Apis mellifera mellifera, then Apis mellifera ligustica, and so on. You can see that those eight subspecies were brought in all before 1900. And these included some kind of weirdos and very cool ones, like Lamarckii from the Nile River Valley, and Cypria and Syriaca, which were both from what's now Palestine and Cyprus. And down there in 1990, we have the African subspecies Scutellata. These are descendants of Scutellata, of course, that came into Brazil in the 1950s and migrated their way into into the United States in 1990. So that's kind of the history of what we have. Okay, and this introduction of honeybees actually represents sort of multiple genetic bottlenecks. Okay, first we know that only 9 of the 26 known subspecies were ever introduced. And for each of these 9 subspecies, it's likely that only a few tens or maybe a few hundreds queens were ever brought in. It's just simply too expensive. Once they got here and you could propagate them, it was much cheaper to buy them from, Bob down the street than to try to get them back from Bulgaria or something. And then the other bottleneck would be the subsequent population expansion and genetic drift in the New World. By 1945, it's estimated there were about 5 million colonies in the United States. Now there's, 2.1 to 2.3 million. Okay, so that's the introduction of those founder populations. The one thing that I want to mention now, just several slides that I feel like I have to, is the overall reduction of the feral and commercial populations by varroa destructor. So as you guys have already heard, after 1987, once varroa arrived in the United States, this mite is believed to be responsible for the widespread decline of the feral honeybee population. Increase the sort of annual losses that beekeepers have to deal with. You heard in the very first talk today that beekeepers have gotten quite good or quite used to replacing colonies that are lost over the winter or that die for whatever reasons. And so that itself, constitutes basically another stepping up or ramping up in this sort of bottlenecking effect. Now, if you think that the loss of the feral populations was trivial, it may have been, but we do have some interesting data. And these data, and some that I'll speak of later, are from a student of mine who just recently finished, Debbie Delaney. The take-home message from this slide, if you look, I don't have a pointer, but if you look over there in Arizona, you'll see that a number of those M haplotypes, these are mitochondrial haplotypes, and by M, what I mean is they're haplotypes that are characteristic of that Apis mellifera mellifera subspecies or some related subspecies that were brought in. Basically, they're not maintained commercially. They were never, no one now, for the most part, believes that they're keeping the dark bee of Northern Europe in the United States. But in Arizona, for example, the frequency of those M haplotypes was about 65%. And throughout all of the South, in this feral population, the frequency was around 30% or 33%. And I'll just tell you, kind of getting ahead of myself, that frequency is very, very low in the commercial populations. In the commercial populations in both the South and the Western U.S., the frequency was less than 5%. So this feral population that we did have represented most likely a significant source of genetic variation that has now been lost because of the varroa mite. And these are samples in the freezer from 1980 to 1991 that were collected during that time. So I don't know if there's Nosema serrani in them. Anyway, so the part that I'd like to concentrate on now, kind of the main take-home crux message for this talk, is that we have a small number of breeder queens that are being used to provide the replacement queens for our commercial populations even now. Probably smaller than you might imagine. Okay, so here's the queen, the kind of thing that is so important to beekeepers. If you have a half a pound of bees in one of these, you can kind of make a colony, and maybe a month or two later you can get $150 for it over in California, So queens are the big thing. And beekeepers can make queens by, taking a colony and dividing it and leaving one half queenless, and they'll raise themselves a new queen. But actually, what kind of happened, and this is so true with so many things in beekeeping, is someone figured out long ago a different system. So a person named Doolittle published in 1888 Scientific Queen Rearing. And what he figured out was that you could take wax cups, or nowadays we use plastic cups oftentimes, and you could graft a larva, a young larva just hatching, you know, that just hatched, and put in that wax cup or plastic cup. You can then put a whole bar of these, or multiple bars of these, in a very strong queenless colony that you're feeding, and they will raise new queens for you. So each of those cells there now contains what will become a virgin queen. You can then take these virgin queens, or these queen cells, and put in these little small colonies here, like these.